You're now listening to The Brian Callen Show with your host, Brian Callen.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Brian Callen Show with just Hunter Motz. Welcome to the dojo. Some more mixed mental arts coming at you today. And I have to say that I'm incredibly excited to have our next guest on because Yasha Monk has said far more articulately something that I've been trying to say for a long time, which is that complacency about our democracy is not a justified feeling. And now that might even seem prescient. I don't know. I probably just guessed correctly. But anyway, so Yasha, tell us what's going on. Should we feel like democracy just sort of runs itself and we can just chill and, pour ourselves a mint lemonade?
Well, a lot of us grew up thinking that, right? Like, it's easy to talk about how terrible everything is and how much we dislike the system because, you know, it's going to be around forever anyway. And we don't really know what the alternative looks like. Let's try something radical. Let's change it all up. And I think that's really dangerous. No political system, in the history of the world has been stable forever. There's systems that are stable for a couple hundred years. And then suddenly something shifts. The people who are living at the time don't see it coming. They don't really understand what's going on. And boom, you have very, very rapid and radical transformation. And I think that, as I'm saying, people who are living through those times, they never know what's going on. And there's, often periods when people think this is about to happen and they turn out to be really wrong. But I think there's reason to worry right now that our world is going to change radically and that we're going to realize that, hey, you know what? A lot of the stuff that I've been railing against, I mean, some of it really was bad, but it can get a whole lot worse.
Well, and I think, it's important to acknowledge here that there might be a reason why you're perhaps more attentive to that possibility than maybe your average Joe, right? Like, is there some sort of family historical experience that makes you aware of that possibility in any human society?
Yeah, I mean, my family has managed to be in the wrong place at the wrong time for about 27 generations.
Right, so let's talk about what is the Jewish experience?
Right. So, my folks come from a corner of, what's now the Ukraine, now that Donald Trump has been elected, may soon be Western Russia. My great grandparents and so on suffered through pogroms. My grandparents, escaped the hometowns, in order to survive the Holocaust. A lot of their family was killed, and when my parents grew up in sort of socialist Poland, until that government turned on them, and they had to flee their country when they were 19, 20 years old because of a sort of anti-Semitic, large-scale pogrom in the late 60s. And when I grew up in Germany, which is a sort of interesting place to grow up Jewish, I was treated pretty well most of the time, but I don't think that anybody quite thought that I belonged. People sort of always assumed because of my name. Certainly if I mentioned that I was Jewish, but I didn't quite, I wasn't really from there. And then for the last 20 years, I've seen in Europe, these more and more radical parties rise in the polls, get more and more votes. Some people who are nostalgic for the fascist past, others who are, trying to look very different from the past, but who really hate on immigrants and foreigners, and not just people, not just in the States. When you say immigrant, mostly you mean somebody who's arrived 5 years ago, right? I mean, you can be in favor of more immigration or in favor of less immigration, but that's an immigrant. I'm an immigrant to this country. I came here 10 years ago. But what people mean by immigrant in Europe is somebody whose grandparents came to the country, but, their skin color is a little different, but he's an immigrant, right? So I've seen the anger against that. I've seen these political systems turn. I wasn't sure that we can be as bullish about the stability of our political system as everybody seems to assume.
And so then, what did you do about that, right? There's this great article from the New York Times that people keep on sending me and being like, get this guy on the show, get this guy on the show. so tell me about this great article from the New York Times.
I'm glad you're getting all the emails from my fake email account.
where are your spammers from? Are they from Macedonia or Bangladesh? Like, what country?
No. It's handmade. I take pride in the work. I set each of the email accounts up. And, So political scientists think basically that what they call democratic consolidation is a one-way street. So at first, you know, you're fledgling democracy. People don't really know whether it works. You're trying to establish the system. It might go wrong. But once a country is pretty wealthy, and once you've changed government through free and fair elections a couple of times, you know, that's when democracy becomes what they call the only game in town. Everybody accepts democracy. Nobody really wants a different kind of form of government. All the politicians who have real power say, you know, we might dislike our political opponent, but we realize that we have to beat them in the elections. And if we lose, that's fine. We give power to them. We'll have another chance to win it back at the next elections, right? That's democracy's consolidated only game in town. And the assumption was that once that happens, there's no going back. You're fine. You're safe. The United States, always going to be a democracy. We started to think about what does it actually mean for something to be the only game in town? When can you actually be sure that that's still the case? And so I thought, look, you want to look at three things, right? You want to look at, is it true that people say it's really important to me to live in a democracy and things like that? You want to look at, well, are people open to alternatives? Are there people who are saying, hey, you know what? Perhaps army rule is better. Perhaps I want a strong leader who doesn't have to bother with elections and parliaments and Congress and all of that stuff. And then you want to make sure that there's not candidates or parties or presidents who threaten to lock up a political opponent,
right,
who say they're not going to accept the outcome of the elections and stuff like that. So I looked at that. And you know, the striking thing is it sometimes sounds in the public debate. So I went out and collected all this data, and I was a sort of worker bee, and I figured all of this out. That data was there. It was publicly available. It's the most famous data set in the social sciences. It's just nobody looked at it. Because nobody was worrying about this.
Wait a minute, but welcome to the experience of this podcast. I mean, you know, for the last 200 plus episodes, we keep on talking to scientists and we're like, wait, like you have an answer to a problem that affects real people's lives and you never bother to tell it to people in a way that they could. And wait a minute, like why is – so I mean the classic example that I use repeatedly on this show is that, you know, 10 years ago I was trying to figure out how do ideas move. And we've come to realize that rule 34 of the internet?
No.
So rule 34 is that if you can imagine it, there is porn of it on the internet.
Oh, yeah. So I had heard about that. No.
So rule 34 also applies to science, which is that, you know, if you can imagine it, there is already science of it. So I started looking around and there's this science.
Rule 35.
Yeah, rule 35. There you go. You heard it here first on the Brian Callen Show. Yasha Monk, the coiner of rule 35. So rule 35. And so I was like, oh, what do we know about how I do? And I was like, oh, there's like a whole field that studies this problem. And oh, there's like a master work in this. And it's called it's called the diffusion of innovations. And it is an innovation that hasn't diffused because it was written in 1967. And, I was recently, like 2 years ago, had a conversation with an evolutionary scientist who was like, man, it's been 150 years. Evolution can't seem to convince the other half of the population. Why is that? You know, we should figure out at some point how ideas move. And I said, aren't you talking about Everett Rogers's The Diffusion of Innovation? And he says, I've heard of Everett Rogers's classic work, but I have never made a close study of it. So, like, he just hadn't bothered to read it. And, like, that's our great experience. It's your experience, which is there's just, like, this data has been sitting around. Nobody's bothered to look at it or use it. So, yeah, so you looked at the data, and what'd you find?
So if I can just backtrack for a little bit, I'm going to start using that phrase. When I haven't read something, I'll say, I haven't made a close study of it.
Right?
I mean, like, you know, in Europe, when you're reading a book, you never say, I'm reading the book. You always say, I'm rereading it.
Uh-huh. Oh, wow. So, but these are...
It's just, you know, never admit to never having read something. Anyway, I hate that sort of stuff. But So there was this data. People had gone out and they've asked, you know, 100 plus countries questions like, how important is it to live in a democracy? But just because political scientists assumed that there can't be anything to worry about. Democracy is safe, so why look at this? So you know, they were looking at it in like Pakistan. They weren't looking at it in the United States and
right.
places like that. So here's what we found. And it shocked me. I mean, when I first looked at this stuff, I was like, God, I mean, I was sort of hoping to find something because I wanted an interesting finding, but I really wish I hadn't found that. So you ask Americans, how important is it to you to live in a democracy? And people born in the 1930s, 1940s, over two-thirds of them say 10 out of 10, really important to me, really crucial. You get to younger people, born since 1980, millennials, less than one-third say it's really important to me to live in a democracy, 10 out of 10. A
so,
ton of people now are just indifferent, but like 5 out of 10. You know what? Democracy, I can take it, I can leave it, don't really care.
But so, I mean, just to put that in another context, right? I mean, let's use some behavioral economics here, right? So essentially two-thirds of people are like, yeah, maybe fascism, like maybe communist totalitarianism, like maybe some sort of totalitarian system where I don't have a vote.
Yeah, so when you look at, so then we go on, so this is like, how important is it to live in a democracy,
right? Right.
So what about the alternative? Perhaps it's like, well, I mean, what does that mean? I mean, how important is it to me to like watch the next lecture? So let's look at a different question, right? The number of people who say that democracy is a bad or very bad way of running the country has gone up a lot. Most
mm-hmm.
shockingly, you say, well, what about, you know, alternatives to democracy? And here, you know, we try to look at the most extreme question, right? Military rule, right? Like, how many Americans want the Pentagon to say tomorrow, you know what, we're taking over the government?
Right.
20 years ago, 1 in 16 Americans said yes to that. So, you know, pretty low. Today, 20 years later, 1 in 6 Americans say that they want army rule. Now, it's still a minority, right? And most Americans still aren't saying that. But it's more than doubled over the course of 20 years. And when you only look at young and affluent Americans, so people in, you know, the highest portions of the income distribution who are born since 1980, it's actually gone up from 6 to 36%. Young people today are six times more likely, young wealthy people, to say they like the idea of army rule than they once did. So, you know, it's important not to get hung up on that data. I mean, it doesn't matter if it's 36 or 34%, how exactly you cut or slice it. And the overall trend is pretty clear and it's pretty worrying. People are pissed off. They don't like the system anymore. They're saying, you know what, let's throw some shit against the wall and see what sticks.
Well, and I think that's the crucial thing is that always humans are really bad at knowing when something isn't working and terrible at knowing how to create something that works better.
Right.
So it's, you know...
Yeah.
Because that's the sort of the one of the big recurring patterns of human history. Like, you know, the French Revolution, do the peasantry have reasons to be pissed? 100%. It was a terrible system for them. But, you know, they were amazing at tearing the system down. And then it took them, I mean, realistically, hundreds of years to figure out a better system.
Look at Syria. I mean,
yeah.
The people who stood up, you know, I mean, Bashar al-Assad is a really, really horrible person. And his regime was very bad as a dictatorship. If you disagreed with him, you would go to prison. He, you know, gave huge advantages to people from his own religious sect and ethnic group. It was a bad place to live. And so a lot of people, you know, hopeful young people stood up and said, this is bad. Look at how bad it is. Let's get rid of it. And they were right. And now Syria is so much worse than it was 5 years ago.
Right.
So, you know, you can chalk it up to... you know, the 37 generations of my ancestors who've all gotten the wrong end of history, who drew the short straw. But you know, I'm really aware of the fact that the worst that politics can do to people is in some ways more important than the best we might achieve. It's so difficult to achieve something really, really great in politics, and it's so easy for politics to go truly, truly wrong, that always makes me a little cautious. And I think that's worth thinking about. I think a lot of people feel they have nothing to lose, right? And I get it. I mean, you know, all through the history of the U.S., people have just become much richer from one generation to the next, right?
Right.
It's one thing, you know, when you're like, look, I'm twice as rich as my parents were. Like I, you know, come home and, like, I have a refrigerator and they, like, didn't have a refrigerator, right? And you know what? I can see that my kid is going to be, like, twice as rich as me. Like, look, I don't like those guys in Washington. Look, I don't... You know, have particular trust in them. I don't think they're great guys, but you know, let's leave them to it. You know, because I can see that things are getting better. Well, a lot of people are saying.
I think that, yeah, I mean, so I think this is where, you know, it's definitely the sort of the larger trend that we've found on this show that nobody's really dealing with. Is the rise of automation and the rise of robotics. And a large part of what you're dealing with is, you know, the middle class has been being hollowed out since the 1970s. And we now understand that that was because of automation and robotics. And, you know, there is, you know, it's you're a worldly guy. You've lived in different cultures. And so inevitably, when you move between cultures, you have to think much more than somebody who just sort of grows up in a single culture. Because, you know, everything is just sort of obvious to you. If you're the high school quarterback, you're like, yeah, like you throw shit and you run and you do that. And then you're like the star and you're like, oh, that was easy. And then suddenly you get onto the world and that thing doesn't work for you and it can be hard to transition. So, but I, you know, one of the consequences of that is that, you know, a lot of people, like my uncles are from Kansas, and they, you know, work in places like the Ford plant and all of that sort of stuff. And so what is happening is that the world is changing around them. They see jobs disappearing. Donald Trump can say, your job was here, now it's gone to China, and we will just bring it back. And they don't understand that there are larger structural forces at work where, you know, your job, you know, if there are 1,000 jobs here, well, those jobs may go to China, but if you bring them back, there will be one job, and that will be the guy who watches the factory full of robots do the job. And so, you know, a large part of what this comes down to is culture. And, you know, there are industrial age intuitions and, you know, much, much older intuitions around learning and the value of education that fundamentally are not setting people up to succeed in this new environment. Like, if we're going to talk about culture, you know, I would say that in general, you know, Ashkenazi Jewish culture is a fairly pro-learning culture. Is that fair?
I guess so, yeah.
Yeah, right? I mean, there's a lot of questioning. You know, I always think that the big contrast, you know, if you compare the sort of the great monotheistic religions, you know, you have Ashkenazi Jewish culture, which is really about reading the Talmud, questioning the Talmud, right? It's, this, you know, this all about intellectual inquiry. Then you have the Protestants where you're supposed to read the book and it's supposed to, but you're supposed to read it in the vernacular and you're supposed to have some level of questioning. Then there's Catholicism, which is my, you know, my mother's religion, which is about as unquestioning as you can get. You know, you're sort of blindly supposed to obey what the Pope says, even though some of the things he seems to be doing don't tend to make a lot of sense. And then, you know, there's Islam. And, you know, Islam in the actual caliphate had this very rich intellectual life. And there was a lot of dissent and a lot of questioning, and their desire for religion drove a lot of innovation in terms of, you know, if you're going to pray five times a day, you have to have damn good clocks and you have to know which way is east. Right. And so a lot of these problems that they were trying to solve for religious reasons led to technological advancement. But then there is this process, which is, you know, super controversial, like so many things, of the closing of the gates of Ijtihad, where they fundamentally decide everything that has been known, that can be known, has been known, and there are no more questions to ask. And there was this moment there where it could have gone either way. They could have gone right. more Aristotelian and more questioning, or they could have shut off those gates. But, you know, I was born in Saudi Arabia. My parents live in Dubai. They lived in Libya and Tunis and all these other places. And I, you know, absolutely, like the Arab culture, there are a lot of great things about it. The tea, the baklava, all of that sort of stuff is amazing. Like you're not, I know that, you know, the Israelis like to think that shawarma is theirs, but I firmly believe that shawarma and falafel are fundamentally Arab contributions to humanity.
You know, I'm happy to, like, you know, debate terrorism and things like that. I'm not going to debate this question because that won't get too much hate mail. It's just not worth it.
On the shawarma question?
Yeah, the shawarma question. It's too. I'm keeping my hand off.
Yeah, it's totally controversial. But the point is that, you know, I mean, the people like Gaddafi were, I mean, you don't, if you're Gaddafi, you do not want a well-educated population. And so he utterly screwed up the culture, like, he, you know, and it's screwed up the culture in a way that doesn't set them up for success. I mean, you know.
I mean, I think, you know, like there's sort of two things that people say about this whole debate that I find, you know, sort of facile. And one is to say, well, none of this has anything to do with culture or religion, right?
Right.
Like we don't want to, you know, seem like we're talking down a particular culture or religion. So let's just say that it has nothing to do with culture or religion at all, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, people, you know, terrorists are terrorists because they're poor or because, you know, their dad beat them. And it's nothing at all to do with those larger things that they claim allegiance to, right? And that seems to me to be sort of clearly silly, right? Like, obviously, it has something to do with the larger culture, with your ideals, and often with your sort of extreme religious beliefs. That's obvious. But then the other thing that people say is like, oh, you know, because, you know, at the moment, a lot of terrorists are motivated in some way by their, you know, extreme interpretation of Islam, that means that Muslims are violent or that Islam is a violent religion. But when you go back over the history of religions, they each had moments of sort of internal civil war between different religious sects. Think of very violent wars between Catholic and Protestant all over Europe for hundreds of years. They each had moments when they were trying to export their religion in a very violent way. Think of the Crusades,
in which Christians
went around and colonized the world, right?
Wait a minute, you think the Crusades? You think that maybe Christianity has a violent, proselytizing past?
perhaps so. I mean, it could just be, right? And so, you know, I think obviously the only way to understand a movement like ISIS is that it is motivated by an extreme interpretation of these religious beliefs. But that's not specific to Islam. That happened in Christianity. It happened even in Buddhism. There's Buddhist monks who are going around terrorizing Muslims in parts of the world, in Burma and other places today.
That's right.
Right. This is possible in every religion.
And so
I want to get back to automation. Can we talk about robots?
Yeah. So I mean, that's the key thing is that, you know, I would agree with you, and that's what we're trying to carve out is a path that is fundamentally focused on a realistic understanding of culture and human thinking. It's not and you know, fundamentalism occurs in any culture, right? You know, the social justice warriors on college campuses who are like shrieking about pronouns are fundamentalists. They're just fundamentalists in the values of their own culture. So there's, you know, the fundamentalism is like Baskin Robbins. There are 52 flavors now, and you can choose your favorite flavor of fundamentalism. But yeah, in terms of robots, I mean, I think the key thing is, you know, one of the things that I've really enjoyed in the wake of the election of Donald Trump is sort of watching people try and make sense of this. And the liberals, you know, have sort of been sort of ping ponging back and forth between it's poverty, it's economics, and it's racism. And they can't figure out, you know, is it one or is it the other? And I'm like,
good.
Well, I was going to say, like, 1933. Like, if you guys are going to keep on drawing parallels to 1933, it's that there was all this economic hardship and people couldn't get by. So all their nasty ass racist thoughts came out.
Exactly. there's many silly debates we've had in the last 3 or 4 weeks, you know?
Yeah.
Like one of the silly debates is about identity stuff, and there's many silly debates, but this is really the silliest of them all, right? Because it's like, well, is it economics or is it race? And it's obviously both, and those two obviously reinforce each other.
Yep.
And we know that from every experiment in social psychology that's ever been done on these kinds of questions, that when people are feeling secure, when they're feeling optimistic about their own future, if you give them, you know, $5 at the beginning of the experiment, they end up having more racially tolerant views. They're not jealous when people of different ethnic groups, you know, succeed in the world. But the moment that you prime them to be a little anxious about the future, feel threatened by something, and these can be very small manipulations, just mentioning something in the text they have to read that makes them a little bit more anxious. Suddenly, they become a lot less racially tolerant. They become much more jealous. They identify with the ethnic in-group much more strongly. So this idea that it's either one or the other is really bizarre. It's obviously both. But I want to make another point here, which is that I'm always struck, and I think, you know, I do this as well. Everybody does this, but I try to watch it, and I think everybody should. Which is, you know, nearly always people have this weird way in which what they think the explanation for something is happens to coincide with what they think their, like, favorite solution is.
Yeah.
So, like, if you like identity politics, you're going to say, this is all about race, it has nothing to do with economics. And if you, like, you know, want a lot of redistribution and higher taxes, you're going to say, this has nothing to do with race, it's all about the fact that, like, people's living standards aren't increasing. And I never understand, or, you know, like, when you think all the way back to the primaries, right, everybody who thought that Bernie Sanders, you know, had better policies also thought that Bernie Sanders was more likely to win.
Yeah.
And everybody who thought that Hillary Clinton has better policies also thinks that Hillary Clinton is more likely to win. I was like, how did that happen? Is it really too complicated to say, you know what, like, I prefer this candidate, but I think whatever candidate is more likely to win, and then sort of tough, right? I got to make my decision. But people, I'm sure you've talked about this in the show, people always want to reduce cognitive dissonance, right? They want all of their beliefs in the world to line up nicely and neatly so that nothing is challenging to them. And that's how we get silly debates like, how dare you say it's about economics? This is downplaying the thing that I think is important, right? Which is ridiculous.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, so there are two things that I'm going to float your way. The first is, are you familiar with Descartes' error?
No. Educate me. Is this rule 46?
26? I'm not in charge of numbering the rules. That's your job, Yasha. So you number whatever.
I'm in Germany, so I'm very meticulous.
Descartes' error. So essentially, you know, people know Kahneman and they know Tversky, and some people know John Haidt, and very few people, unfortunately, know Antonio and Hannah Damasio at USC. Antonio Damasio wrote this book called Descartes' Error, and I'll briefly tell you. So the basic idea is that Descartes' error was that thinking and feeling were separate. And what happened is that, you know, in neuroscience, so I'll tell you a quick hilarious story. So I was once, when I used to work at Cold Spring Harbor, which is a lab, we were having this talk was being given, and this guy is saying, oh, there's this disease that we have, and, you know, in vitro it behaves like Parkinson's, but we don't actually know how it works in real human beings. So a German guy named Clemens puts his hands up and says, well, why couldn't you take a brain biopsy from someone who is living? And the speaker is like appalled and is like, generally we don't take the pieces out of people whose brains who are living because that tends to cause paralysis or death. And Clemens is undeterred and he says, but why couldn't you take the brain out of someone who is like not using it like a vegetable? So, you know, the moral ethical standards of Germans, at least some of them, have not fundamentally changed in the last 70 years. But so this is a real problem. You can't actually chop bits out of people's brains and see what happens unless they have a tumor. And so there was this guy named Elliot who had a tumor that was right up above behind his nose, and the guy was going to die. So they removed the tumor. And then the question becomes, what did that piece do? Like, what did we fundamentally change? And at first, it seemed like they hadn't changed anything. It seemed like they had removed an utterly functionless bit of the brain. But what ended up happening, you know, his IQ was still in the 97th percentile. You know, this is a guy who was a successful family man. You know, he worked in finance. Everything was working perfectly, except that suddenly his decision making went to crap. You know, he left his wife and married a stripper. He could no longer be any good at his job, you know, and he fell for a bunch of different con men, and he couldn't decide where to go for lunch. And he would sit there for, you know, 3-4 hours trying to rationally calculate where should I go to lunch based on table availability, you know, nutritional information.
I'm glad he was being so rational about lunch. But
yeah, exactly.
About the stripper. That's a good...
but he's trying to solve it essentially using humanity's limited capacity for reason. And the problem is that these aren't problems that are solved purely rationally, because where you want to go for lunch is a gut decision. You feel like Thai food, you feel like borscht, you feel like whatever it is. No one ever feels like borscht. But the point is that, you know, you're being driven by emotions. And so the point of Descartes' error, and, you know, one of the things that I've been really trying to drive on this, because it's been hugely important in my own life and just in my own work with students, is thinking and feeling are always linked. And the problem is that we waste a tremendous amount of time dealing with people's rationalizations when we should be really looking at, okay, how do you feel about this? Like, you don't like this economic theory, but why is that? Right? Like,
yeah,
let's talk about your feelings. But so that's the first thing. And then the second thing that we've just found incredibly useful on this podcast, just as a way to quickly understand this, is the stories of cargo cults. So did you know the cargo cult story?
No, go ahead.
Okay. So in the 19th...
Unless you say it on your podcast all the time and all your listeners are like, not that story again.
Well, I can tell it very quickly. It's certainly a story that I never tire of hearing. And, you know, if our podcast just becomes you and me, Asha, and like everybody else just tunes out, I'm cool with that. Like,
I'm having fun. Bye, guys.
It won't matter if the whole world falls apart. We'll, at the end of it, we'll have these great cell phone plans, joke from before the show. And, you know, we'll just sort of be talking back and forth. But the cargo cults, what happens is that, in the lead up to World War II, you know, there are these people on Papua New Guinea, and they're isolated in the highlands, and they've had no contact with the outside world, so they're still Stone Age cultures. And suddenly they start seeing these airplanes flying overhead, and you can imagine if you're a Stone Age person and you suddenly see an airplane, it's utterly mind-blowing. And so these airplanes start dropping all this cargo into the jungle, and they, you know, find some of these packages and they open them up, and, you know, there are stone tools and there are metal tools and spam and all sorts of wonders from the West. And they're like, this cargo is amazing. How do we get more of it? And so they go off through the jungle and they find the nest of these giant metal birds, right, the landing strip, and they watch and they see what's going on. And then they go back off into the jungle and they decide to recreate the ritual. And so they build their own landing strip and they build these giant airplanes out of twigs and bark. And hundreds of men stand around them and go, and they wait for the twig airplane to go and take off and bring them back the cargo. And then when the ritual doesn't work, they go back and they look at the landing strip and they see, oh, there's a tower. And so they build their own tower and they send a man up into the tower and they put a half coconut on each ear. And he plays at air traffic controller because they think that's part of the magic of how this happens. So,
right.
Go ahead.
You know what I love about this story?
Yeah.
That's perfectly reasonable, right? Like, there's a way of looking at this and sort of thinking like, oh, look at those idiots who are unscientific and stupid. But they're not. Like, we don't have a developed sort of natural scientific view of how the world works, because that's something that's really difficult to put together and took us thousands of years. And it was through a bunch of lucky coincidences, but we got there. But they actually are trying to reason through this, right? So do you know the story of the anthropologist and the marbles?
No, tell it.
All right, let me tell you a straight story.
Yeah.
So there's this British anthropologist, and he goes to work on, you know, this very remote tribe somewhere in rural Uganda, up in the mountains. And, you know, they have a rain man who makes it rain, and he's very important in their sort of religious scheme of things, which is what he's trying to understand. So he keeps asking them, you know, can I come and see the rain man? Will you take me up the mountain? He lives up at this big, imposing mountain. Can you take me up the mountain to see the rain man? And they're like, no, we don't trust yet, you know. And after 6 months of living with these people, eventually they're like, you know what? All right, we trust you. We'll take you to see the rain man. And so we climb up this incredibly dangerous path. You know, he nearly dies. He makes it up the mountain. He meets the rain man. You know, they're sitting down. He's serving him, you know, I don't know, Lipton tea or something. Probably not. And he's like, all right, well, so listen. So how do you make it rain? How do you do it? And the rain man says, well, I have a powerful stone, which is magic, which has been passed down to me, you know, by my ancestors for many generations. There's only one of them in the world. It's completely unique. And when I rub it a particular way and do a particular incantation, you know, most of the time, the next day, it rains. And he says, oh, that's amazing. I mean, I know it's a very secret and magic stone, but can I take a look? And he's like, okay, I'll produce my stone for you. You're a trusted friend. And he takes out the stone, and it's a marble. It's a child's marble. Right? We play marbles. It's a standard marble. And the anthropologist goes back to the next town. He has some friends there, you know, hangs out with them. They have a kid who's playing with marbles, and he says to the kid, hey, could I have one of your marbles? So, you know, he goes back to the mountains. He asks him to take him up to see the weatherman again. He climbs up the dangerous mountain again. He nearly dies. He gets there, and he says, look, I know you said there's only one of these stones in the world, and I don't mean any disrespect, but I found one that's just like yours. And the rain man is, you know, it's bewildered. That's not possible. That's only one of them. I'm sure you don't have another one that's like it. And so it's like, well, here it is. And he takes up the marble, and the rain man is amazed, right? He stares at this stone and says, my God, you're right. It looks just the same. And so the anthropologist says, so what do you think? Is this going to be magic as well? Can you make it rain with this stone? And the rain man looks at the anthropologist, and he looks at the marble, and he looks at the anthropologist again, and he says, I don't know. Shall we give it a try? And that, to me, is the core. It's like he's thinking about this rationally. Right?
Yeah.
Like it's not that he's like some idiot who doesn't have sort of an empirical mindset. It's just that it's really difficult to do science. And so he's trying to work with the best rules or the best perception of what he has. But he still has means and rationality.
Well, so let's talk about science. Because specifically, right, we all know that any tribe or any group of people tell myths about themselves that make them look good and make them seem magical and special and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and we have a wonderful liberal democracy that will never fail. Go on.
That's right. Exactly. But so science has also myths that it is told about itself. And it says, the source of our great magic is we have this thing called the scientific method, right? And that's what makes science possible. But you have to remember that, when science sort of began, in this sort of slow incremental process 300-400 years ago, they didn't have any science yet. They didn't really know what humans were good at. And so they were really sort of guessing at, like, what are we good at, right? They had a cargo cult that they founded, and it was based on this idea of reason, which it turns out that actually we're not very – there's no separate thing, such thing as separate reason, right? Reason and emotion are linked. So, that doesn't hold up. And then separately, the scientific method thing. And one of my favorite experiences – there's a lot of our thinking here is based on the work of Joe Henrich, who's does evolution, cultural evolution. And, he has this – every single time I've interviewed him, he has this thing that he goes into where he's exploring heresy. He's exploring the heresy of the scientific culture where he's saying, theory is great, but, like, I don't know that it's so great because – you kind of have to have a few steam engines before you can have a theory. Like, you have to have a few of them lying around before you can have a theory of steam engines. So sometimes practice comes before theory. Like, sometimes you're just sort of doing stuff and it's working, and then you're like, why is it working? And the reality is that, the more and more you think through this and the more you realize that, that first scientists sort of had to make up ideas about what they were good at, the more you realize that, in fact, a lot of that doesn't hold up. So what is science really about? Well, humans don't have problems making theories. Like, you can go on the internet and there's a million and one theories, right? There's no shortage of theories on the internet, right? There's conspiracy theories. There's all that sort of stuff. The hard thing for humans is to break theories and to let go of the theory that they have and then, have to make up a better one. And the point is that science designs these things like, for example, the Damasio's and the Descartes error and the experiment with Eliot, where it's like, man, how do I explain that? Like, the guy literally can't think without feeling. I guess thinking and feeling are always linked, right? And so it's these super clear things that are designed to test and break our own thinking. But again, science sort of tells this often, and, having grown up hardcore in the world of science, this myth sort of floats around that essentially every human was wasting their time. And then science showed up, and then we got serious about solving problems, and then diseases were cured and all that sort of stuff. But there are real problems with this thinking, like the fact that, actually a lot of things that earlier cultures came up with about human psychology and human behavior are really good and hold up well. And then the other problem is that, realistically, you can't be breaking your theories about how the stars work or about how bacteria work until you have a telescope and a microscope. So a lot of it is just about having tools available and having had the technology. And so what ultimately comes out of all of this science is a view of human history where it is just one long line of cultural evolution and cultural accumulation. And, to try and draw a line anywhere in that process is utterly ridiculous. Where you say, before we weren't really doing it, and now we're really doing it.
Right. Yeah, and that's one of the toughest questions, I think, right? Like, at every age, there was things that people believed that seemed sort of self-evidently wrong in retrospect.
Mm-hmm.
I believe in the scientific method. I believe in rational discourse. But there's some things we're getting wrong, and I don't know what they are, but I think it's worth dwelling on what those might be, right? Like, what are the things that seem really obvious to us, where we're in fraud to some idea, either because you know, we need to believe it for political reasons or because we just don't really have an alternative theory available to us, right? Mm-hmm. Like a lot of the time, you know, we can sort of tell that something isn't quite right. Some story we're telling ourselves doesn't quite make sense, but we just don't have an alternative story that can make sense of this. So we cling on to this because that's the best way we can make sense of the world, right? So I don't know. I mean, do you think?
Well, I can tell you that one of them, that from what we've learned on this show, is Descartes' error. Like, that's a huge, huge problem. Because in practice, what ends up happening is you're describing a neurological process. And like, for example, the word rational and reason get thrown around a lot. But in fact, you're talking about two totally different cognitive processes. One is rationalizing, where you just have your existing feelings and beliefs and you're trying to defend them. And the other one is being reasonable, where you're like sitting there and you're like, this is what you're saying is really uncomfortable for me. I don't like it. Oh, but I think I should probably change my belief in light of evidence and, you know, probably it will make my life better in the long run, right? So there's, I think part of it is just sort of, I mean, you know, in order for any sort of intellectual accountability or discourse to work, you know, there has to be, you want a society that understands rationalizing and reasonable are two totally different things. And, you know, that's a large part of what happens in academia. You know, the behavioral economics economists, for example, are constantly dealing with people rationalizing the idea of rational agent theory. And, know, like the problem is scientific accountability can't work because essentially, like, if you're an economist who believes in rational agent theory, like, you have an immense amount of education and you can rationalize until the end of time. But that doesn't,
and it's also about incentives, right? I mean, like when you talk about rational agent theory, you know, that's a huge problem in the social sciences. And I don't, you know, I think you can get a lot of useful stuff out of rational choice and rational agent theory. But there's also some things that obviously can't explain, right? So for one, you know, a whole bunch of people at these last elections voted for a candidate whose tax proposals were. You know, a whole bunch of people voted for this candidate because they're pissed off that they don't have more money. They feel like, you know, Washington, D.C. is a swamp that they want to drain but doesn't do anything for them, right? And they voted for a candidate whose tax plan is to cut billions of dollars of taxes for the rich and not really do anything for the poor. And so, you know, like you can't get at that in a simple way with rational agent theory. But you know, the way that, and, you know, social sciences isn't quite natural sciences. I think it would be good if we were more aware of the distinction between the two. But it now works on the natural science model. And the problem is that in order to publish in academic journals, you have to engage in a very narrow, predefined debate. You have to clear a very particular methodological bar, and it's easy to do that if you just use the methods that the field has been using, like rational choice and statistics and so on. And so, you know, if you're a young PhD student and there's a pretty scary job market out there, it's tough to get a job as a professor. It's tough to get tenure if you get a job as an assistant professor. All of your incentives are just keep doing this. And you might have private doubts. You might think, you know, are we really just, you know, rearranging the proverbial deck chairs on the Titanic? But, you know, it's better than not having a job. And then over time, this is another really important thing. You know, I really don't think that most people are capable of having this big disjoint between what they do and what they believe. You know, there's a couple of psychopaths who are going around saying, what I do has no value in the world, or perhaps it's even evil. But you know what? I'll do it anyway. This is good for me. There's a few people like that, but very few. Nearly everybody, you know, from Donald Trump to Che Guevara to George W. Bush to you know, Adolf Hitler for that reason, for that matter, they, I think, have convinced themselves what they're doing is good for the world, or at least good for the people who they think matter.
Yep. Right?
There's very few people who think, I'm a bad person, but I'm going to go be a bad person because it'll make me a bunch of money, right? Or it'll give me a lot of power. They think, no, I want power. They want power for whatever effed up psychological reasons. But they're telling themselves, I want power because I'll do good for the world, right?
Right.
And so eventually, I don't know how I got from social science to that. It's a little bit of a far stretch. But when you're doing this, you're not going to be able to keep telling yourself, you know what I'm doing is not relevant, or this method might not really be explaining that many things. If your incentive is to do that method, and you want to reduce that cognitive dissonance. You don't want to admit to yourself that what you're doing doesn't quite capture reality, you will become more and more ideological about it. You'll say, no, this is the right way to study this. We haven't quite figured it out yet, but we will eventually. This is the way to go. And so look, I mean, scientists are human beings,
yep.
right? I think science is the best method we have. Peer review is a great institution, but the people doing this are still humans, and they're still subject to group biases. They're still subject to, you know, worries about whether if they disagree with their colleagues, they may no longer be able to put dinner on the table for their kids. So yes, we need to believe in science. We need to believe in facts, but we need to always interrogate them critically ourselves and to be aware of the fact that science is the best we can do, but it doesn't mean that everything a scientist says is right. Not because of conspiracy theories, not because, you know, I don't know, somebody is paying them to make up stuff about climate change or like whatever some of the more paranoid parts of the right might be claiming. Not that sort of stuff. But there's reasons why scientists might get some things wrong.
Well, and, you know, I mean, I think the first thing is I'm a big fan of Upton Sinclair's quote that it's impossible to convince a man of something when his job depends upon him not understanding it.
Right.
And that's a large part of it. And then, you know, we're going to have to wrap this up, but, you know, we'd love to have you back on. But I'm going to float you a bold idea that we've been developing on this podcast, and we'd like to recruit you for this movement.
All right.
Are you ready?
I'm always, when I hear the word movement, I'm always reluctant.
Yeah, I know, and I can understand why. But specifically, the movement that we are pushing for, and I'll quickly delineate it, is that we think that after 300 years, or however, wherever you want to start the clock, that it's time to consolidate all of the science and figure out what we figured out. Because these ideas are not moving, we know that there's a problem between science communicating with the public, but they're also not moving internally within academia. And so the scientific principle is absolutely perfect, as you say, but the institution, the establishment, is not necessarily living it as fully as it can. And, you know, us sitting here and just sort of interviewing all these academics, we see patterns that aren't necessarily obvious from within academia. And I think that a large part of what's gone wrong is that science has internal accountability, but it has lost external accountability where, you know, essentially I, you know that somehow the economists are not delivering prosperity to me, but I don't understand why, because there's so much complex rationalizations, and you need to empower the people to be able to say, hey, you know, this whole rational agent theory, that doesn't work well. It's, by the way, not what Adam Smith actually taught. This is one of the things that you find out is that Adam Smith wrote two books. The first one was The Theory of Moral Sentiments, and the opening line of that is about altruism. But apparently...
Can I jump in for just a sec? So
yeah.
When I was an undergrad, one of my great teachers was this sort of crazy Hungarian guy called István Hon. And he was really annoyed that people would always portray Adam Smith as though he was what he called, you know, like sort of Chicago economics, right?
Yep.
This sort of like hard, sort of laissez-faire, you know, just like minimal state, sort of ideological kind of movement. And so his first lecture on Adam Smith with his heavy Hungarian accent was, the first thing you have to understand about Adam Smith is that he was Scottish moral philosopher, not Chicago economist.
Exactly. But,
right?
But so the point is that these, you know, it's no different than Christianity in the sense that, like, most of these guys are, like, doing shitty things in the name of Jesus, but they've never ever bothered to read the Bible. And that's you know, your Hungarian professor whose name I won't even try and pronounce, like, that's his frustration. And I think the point is that there needs to be accountability across academia where we, you know, sort out the false prophets from the people who actually have read and understood the work and who's, I mean, fundamentally, a lot of this stuff has to piece together and fit together well, because what you end up finding is your conclusions make sense, but then I just talked to a guy last week who said this thing, and I think that if you put those two things together, then suddenly you'll find your mind has to change.
Right.
So the point is that's what we're doing is that we're organizing a coalition of science writers and you know, friendly, reasonable academics who are more interested in the progress of science than in defending their pet theory to sort of, you know, move those ideas and hold people accountable and have a scientific reformation.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great idea. I mean, if you actually get people to talk to each other and figure out problems beyond disciplinary boundaries, that's exactly right. The problem is that, you know, everyone is going to say, hey, I'm happy to do that. That sounds great. I always, you know, talk to everybody. But then as soon as they're actually in a room with each other, they're like, oh, but how can I believe your findings if you're not using my methodology?
Right? Well, and that's where the general public comes in, because the point is that if you put enough outside pressure on, then people will have to deliver and they'll have to step up.
Yeah.
So
and that's right. I mean, universities are completely insulated from public pressure at the moment. And it's good that they're insulated from political pressure, right? We don't want Donald Trump to be able to say, hey, you know what, if you're in political science, research has to be about how great I am. But I think, you know, I'm always skeptical of this idea. People say art for art's sake, right?
Yeah.
Now they're saying political science for political science's sake. Well, you know what? The world is burning.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm not doing political science for political science's sake. I'm doing political science to figure out the threats to liberal democracy and to think about how we can reform the system so that people have a real stake in it again and that they're willing to fight to defend what's good in our country.
That's right. And let academia serve the people. Let's drain the swamp of academia and let's make academia great again.
no comment.
No comment. But anyway, Yasha, this is great. We're going to get you back on the show. And then also, I am going to email you and we're going to talk more about this. But just so you know, there is this brilliant New York Times article, How Stable Are Democracies? Warning Signs Are Flashing Red, by Yasha, or about Yasha and his research. And then also, and we didn't even really get to talk about it, Stranger in My Own Country, which is Yasha's book about growing up Jewish in Germany. So it's an excellent book, and we will talk more, and I'm excited to change the world and bring us back from the brink so that we can, you know, restore people's faith in the democratic ideal. And that was the Brian Callen Show, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you so much for tuning in and listening, and we will talk to you soon. Keep practicing your mixed mental arts at mixedmentalarts.club.
You've been listening to the Brian Callen Show with Brian Callen. Be sure to like him on Facebook. Just search for Brian Callen Comedy and follow him on Twitter. Just search for @BrianCallen. You can also find him online by visiting his website. Just go to briancallen.com. Until next time, bye-bye.